Great to have you along the ride. Thanks a lot for stopping by. Always glad to have this young lady back. She is a clinical psychologist, and it's Dr. Katie Kuhlman. Doctor, how are you? Good to see you.
I'm well, Joe. How are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Glad that we're doing like a monthly thing now. I think this is excellent. And there's always something that we can talk about, whether it's the mentality of parents when they deal with what's being taught in their kids' schools, or when we have tragedies that unfold like we see today in Brooklyn, New York. I want to go there, if you don't mind. This morning, as you know, some guy gets on a train on a subway in New York. 10 people end up getting shot. As of our recording, it doesn't look like anybody's going to die, thank God. But 10 people are hurt by his gunshot wounds, some of them critical. Another 6 people, again, this could change as the reporting happens through the day, are injured. And Katie, this is how my brain works. The first thing I thought of is some television show in the 70s or 80s, and you're way too young to know this, but there was a plane crash. The movie was about a plane crash, and one guy is walking around. He survived the plane crash, and he's like in the swamplands in Florida, and he's walking around holding his briefcase, and he's looking at his watch. He says, "I was in a plane crash, and my watch isn't working." And that was just, it was such an odd reaction, but I'm guessing psychologically, our brains do something to protect us, and that might be what he was depicting. So, big long lead-in. If you're on the subway, God forbid, and something tragic is happening in front of you, what's the human reaction? Is it different for everybody?
Well, for most people, you know, the thing is that most of us have not been through any kind of massive trauma. Most of us have not ever been involved in a mass shooting or been shot at. And so we really don't know what the reality of that is like until we're actually in that moment. So the people that are on the subway, you know, tip for most of them, there is that moment, you know, usually a few seconds, maybe 10 to 20 seconds of absolute disbelief. And when you look back at other mass shootings, for example, and you interview some of the survivors, what they say is that they didn't recognize that it was a shooting going on in the right moment. For example, during The Dark Knight, many of the people in the movie theater thought that what was happening was that it was like a 4D experience, right, opening night of a movie, and you know that it was part of the movie. And so your mind doesn't automatically go to shooting. And you know, is it protective in that moment? No, because we really want to see the body react, but most people just simply are not trained to do that.
Yeah, that theater shooting was in Aurora, Colorado some years ago, and you're right. He walked in some sort of weird gear that could have been part of the movie, and he just started shooting people, and eventually they realized, oh my God, he's shooting people. When I saw some video from the subway this morning, one piece of video stands out to me. There's a guy who, along with everybody else, once they realize it's gunshots, is trying to get off the train, but he's really holding on to his coffee. And I was just thinking to myself, this guy's coffee is so important that he's trying to save his life, you know, slowly. He wasn't like running off the train, and he wanted to make sure he didn't spill his coffee. I mean, it's just, again, we're in such a system of muscle memory. We ride the subway to work. We have our coffee from our favorite place in the morning. And that was an important part of that guy's survival mode was, like, I would have left the coffee there, Katie. I'd been gone. You know what I mean? But it's almost as if that was part of his routine. Okay, there's a shooting happening. Let me get off. I still have my coffee. Does that make any sense?
Well, it does. And I have an interesting story about that too, but sure. Sometimes it's like, it's this security blanket, right? Like that was the thing that was holding on, that he was holding on to. And that's what he's going to leave with. He came right on the train with it. He's going to leave with it. And you know, I have a friend and a colleague who was in the military at Fort Hood when the second Fort Hood shooting started, and he was in the room where it happened. And one of the things that he told me was that what he was holding on to a stack of papers. And he was saying, you know, in the military, you have to hold on to all of these papers. They're so important. And he's like, all I could think about during the shooting was I can't lose this stack of papers.
Wow.
And so it's really interesting, just kind of in the midst of a crisis like that, what people's brains will go to. In a way, it does serve as a sense of safety, right? Because then you're not focused on all of the trauma going on around you. It kind of gives you a little bit of an escape for a moment.
DrKuhlman.com, KUHLMAN.com. Go there. It's Dr. Catherine Kuhlman. We get to call her Katie here. So as we're watching this unfold, you said something earlier that was interesting. You don't really register immediately that it's a gunshot that you're hearing. And although I've got guns and I go to the range, I'm not the normal person necessarily riding the subway in New York. And you might not realize that it's a gunshot. I mean, it's always glorified and amplified and louder and different on a movie or on a television show. When you're on the subway, you hear a loud noise. You're thinking, bah, it's just subway noise. That's probably why it doesn't register, right? A, you don't think anybody's going to shoot up the subway. And B, you might not audibly know what it sounds like.
Right. We live in a state of denial, and living in a state of denial does serve to protect us most of the day. If we just walked around, you know, the world thinking that we were going to be the victim of a mass shooting at any given moment, we would never leave our house.
Right.
So we do have to have a healthy sense of denial. But you're right. You know, you hear a sound on the subway, you think, okay, maybe it's a bump, or like there's a scrape or something. Maybe it's something electrical, or who knows, right? And, you know, even people who are trained with guns, like you and I, right, like we know what we can probably decipher the sound between a gunshot and a firework, for example.
Right.
But in the midst of a crisis like that, you know, of course, number one, no one's wearing ear protection, so it's going to sound a little bit different.
Yes.
But the environment is completely different. And so what the body does and how it reacts, it can vary. And so, yeah, you don't always really catch it right away.
Back in the mid to late 90s, my wife and I and a couple of our kids went to New York. And we were riding the subway. And for some reason, it jumps out at me that it was the 7 subway. I don't know why. Maybe it wasn't. But I think it was the 7. And we're on there. And we've got, like, kids in strollers. And we're waiting to go see the World Trade Center or something. And a group of young men got on the train, 4 or 5 of them, pretty big, late teens. And they said, everybody's attention. We're going to do a dance for you. You're going to watch the dance, and then you're going to give us all your money. And we're going, oh, man. I mean, we're getting robbed right now. And it was interesting because at that moment, some guy looked like he'd worked in a construction job all day. Stands up, walks up to them, says something quietly in the one guy's ear, and the guy says, all right, we got to go. Have a good day. And then they were gone. Obviously, there was an undercover cop. There was security on these subway lines. There's a change in the safety of New York City, Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit because of the defund the police movement. I don't think, and I'm pretty clear on this, that there was a cop on that train today. There used to be in the mid-late 90s when Rudy Giuliani was the mayor, there used to be a cop on every train, usually undercover, to make sure that you're safe. We can't feel safe like that anymore. But what are your thoughts when it comes to the life and times of an NYPD officer today compared to the mid-late 90s when they did have support, when they were out there to do their job to protect and serve? Now they're the target most of the time of somebody's angst. And we've literally taken away the amount of police officers we used to have, making something like today possible to happen.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I feel like a lot of these larger cities, not only have they stripped funding away, and there's an overall just distrust and, you know, people don't like police in a lot of these larger cities. And as a result, police departments are not, you know, they don't have the resources to put officers on trains or to put them in these roles where they really are serving more as a proactive type of role, because they're so focused on responding call to call to call, because again, they just don't have the number of bodies to do what they need to do. And so that's huge for law enforcement officers. That's not why they get into the profession in the first place. Most of the time they get into it because they want to help protect their communities, and they want to, you know, trust the community and have the community trust them and have great relationships. And they truly want to protect and serve. And so that's really unfortunate. And if I'm a cop in NYC right now, I don't even want to be on that subway, you know, just for my fear of my own safety. And, you know, there's this just overarching feeling in a lot of these cities where if you're a cop, you're not going to admit that to people. You're not going to say, yeah, I'm a law enforcement officer, because like you said, it puts a target on their back. And there's this just sense of lawlessness, and criminals do have the upper hand, especially in New York.
Clinical psychologist Dr. Katie Kuhlman. Katie, I appreciate the insight. You know, I was at the gym today on the treadmill. I'm looking up. There's CNN here, and there's Fox over here. Fox is reporting the facts in the case. CNN had Eric Adams, the mayor of New York, complaining about gun violence, complaining about guns doing this and too many guns in the street. Then he gives a number of how many guns there are on the street. Of course, you and I both know that a gun is an inanimate object. It can't get up and shoot anybody. My friend Ted Nugent says he's got a machine gun that's been sitting on his kitchen table for 3 days, and it still hasn't shot anybody. He's surprised. This isn't about the tool they're using. This is about a violent mentality. This is about a knowledge that there probably won't be any police there to stop me from doing it. And this is about not protecting the people. What do you say to people who are sort of middle of the road? Let's say they're not left, they're not right. They're sort of just right down the middle Americans who don't know what to think about this gun talk. Guns are bad. Second Amendment is bad. You had Biden yesterday talking about the Second Amendment and how he wants to get rid of assault rifles. And some guy out hunting deer said, hey, why do you want to take away my magazines and my assault rifles? And Biden says, well, you can't get the deer before it runs away. The Second Amendment has nothing to do with deer. You and I both know that. It has to do with protecting ourselves, our stuff, and our people from tyranny of government and also from bad guys. So what do you say to somebody who just isn't sure what to think about guns in America today?
Well, people really need to do the research. You know, a lot of the people who are, you know, staunch anti-gun, they don't know anything about firearms. They think that an assault rifle is an actual thing. They think that, you know, when you hear the word semi-automatic, that it's a machine gun. And right. that couldn't be further from the truth, right? And so what I would really like to see is that before anybody makes a decision, that they actually do some research and they learn about, you know, how firearms operate, how they're used, and the actual statistics. And the reality is, too, is that we want the good guys to outweigh the bad guys, right? Bad people and criminals, they simply don't follow laws.
Right.
And it's not like we can go back completely to the drawing board and just get rid of guns across the board. I mean, guns are here to stay. We are a nation that owns guns. And so we have to figure out a way then to make sure that the good guys have them. And so that's what I would say. If people are middle of the road, we're not going to live in a society without guns. And so which side are you going to be on? Be well informed, listen to both sides, and then make a decision.
DrKuhlman.com is your website, K-U-H-L-M-A-N. Make sure you go and check out Dr. Catherine Kuhlman. Katie, what you said is so exactly where I was trying to get with the not having a good guy with a gun on the subway. When you have fewer police officers that are good guys with guns, and then add to that places like Chicago, New York City, some of the hardest places to get a license to carry. I'm in Texas. I can carry my gun anywhere I want. And I'm a good guy. I'm not going to hurt anybody. I hope to never, ever shoot the gun in an aggressive manner towards anybody else. I will if I have to defend. But that's really the bottom line. We've got 400 million guns in the country. And most of them will never, ever shoot anybody. The bad guys are somehow doing bad things. And instead of focusing on the nature of the crime, we focus on the weapon that was used. Do you think, as a clinical psychologist, are we doing anything to tell would-be criminals that we're going to stop you before you do it by complaining about the tool they used?
No, not at all. And if you look at a lot of these larger cities, what they're doing with bail reform, you have violent criminals, they get arrested, and it becomes a revolving door with jail. They're in jail for a little bit, they get out on probation, and then they go back and commit crimes all over again. And so we have to think about the message that is sending to criminals and would-be criminals. And that message is that it's really not that big of a deal. You can get away with it. You're just going to be in jail for a couple of days. It's really not serving the deterrent that it should be.
What's interesting is I have this argument about capital punishment. I have no idea what your thoughts are on capital punishment. But I'm for capital punishment in that if you kill somebody, and I'm also for it if you rape somebody or you're a pedophile, but that's a different story completely. But if that's there and that's looming, if you do this crime, you'll die. I think that could be a pretty good deterrent. The argument from the other side is there's no proof of that. If you go and see those who are being put to death, others aren't not doing the crime because they could be put to death. And my answer to that, of course, is how do you know? I mean, if they didn't kill somebody, how do you know that they didn't kill somebody because of that deterrent that was there? They might have thought to themselves, I'd like to kill that guy, but I don't want to die as a result. How can you ever quantify that? So when it comes to punishments as a deterrent, psychologically, in the mind of somebody who could be a criminal, isn't, but is thinking about committing some crimes, they really do work, right? I mean, you're looking at California where you could walk in and steal $950 from the CVS and nobody's even going to stop you. There's no deterrent.
Well, the problem is, you know, and if you want to, you know, kind of dumb this down and talk about like raising a child, and when you punish a child, you don't wait 6 months to
exactly.
punish them for something that they did, right? Punishments, in order to be effective or in order to be a deterrent moving forward, have to be swift, and they have to be in line with what the crime or the bad behavior was, right? There can't be a lot of time that's passed by, and so we have criminals. It takes 2 years to go to trial, sometimes even longer, especially if it's a capital crime. They're sitting in jail until then, but it's, you know, it's cushy, and typically they're in solitary confinement anyway, and they're, right. you know, kind of protected. But then if they get the death penalty, you're looking at so many years of appeals. And so by the time that actually happens, is it a deterrent? Not really, because there's so many options to change up the sentence and go back. And so unfortunately, the way that our judicial process works, because it's so slow, oftentimes doesn't serve as the deterrent that it should.
DrKuhlman.com. Go to our website, Dr. Catherine Kuhlman, clinical psychologist. Last question, Doc. I've got to know, when it comes to, because you deal with first responders a lot in your practice, when it comes to the left now saying, well, we don't really want to defund the police, let's refund the police, we're not really going to defund them. We're seeing Black Lives Matter, the leaders of that organization, buying $6 million mansions here, there, and in Canada. And they're just using the money that was donated. So they weren't really serious about going and helping, you know, Philly and New York and Chicago. What are you hearing from the first responders? Do they believe the 180 that's being done by those who wanted to defund the police? Do they believe that we're waking up to BLM, the organization, was just a way to embezzle money from people who were donating? Are they skeptical still?
Well, they're absolutely skeptical. You know, you got to walk your talk. And right now, it's all just talk.
Yeah.
Politicians can say whatever they want, but until they're actually doing something about it, no one's going to believe it. And I think right now, just because, you know, we've got an election coming up, is this just, you know, because it wasn't a good look politically, or because there's some actually truth behind it? We'll see.
Well, I mean, it's very, very pertinent that you said there's an election coming up, because suddenly they even tried to say Republicans were the ones that tried to defund the police. That's how stupid the whole thing is. Katie, I appreciate you. It's Dr. Catherine Kuhlman. Go to drkuhlman.com. Thanks so much for coming on, and great knowledge, especially today with that traffic in New York. Thank you so much.
Have a good one.
All right. We're back after this. Stay right here.
Joe Pags.